This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, weeks after the non-indictment of former officer Darren Wilson in the killing of Michael Brown, protests continue at an unprecedented rate across the country.
170 cities, twice as many as the rebellions after the murder of Martin Luther King. Is this the beginning of a new civil rights movement?
We'll look into a new law proposed by Republicans in Ohio to keep all aspects of executions in that state a secret.
Well, this is really perverse. Not only are these people in favor of the death penalty, but they don't want people to know about how it's carried out.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the A.J. Mustey Memorial Institute.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
We have Michael Ratner joining us from London. Michael, I understand that we suffered a big setback on the Obama plan to close Guantanamo. Could you tell us what happened?
Well, the newspapers are all calling what recently happened in Congress major setback for Obama's plans to close Guantanamo. And yes, it wasn't great, but was it really a major setback? Or has it just been Obama's clay feet which have failed to close Guantanamo? Here's what happened. Congress was considering the question of whether to allow Guantanamo detainees to be resettled in the United States. That's something Obama wants to do, because so far he's been unwilling to resettle them in other countries, or the majority of the people who are there now. That bill failed, and so when we get the National Defense Authorization Act or whatever legislation it's put in, it will have transfer restrictions of a sort, but it will not permit detainees to be transferred to the United States. So yes, it's a setback. But is it a major setback? Is that the reason Obama hasn't closed Guantanamo? Well, no, that's not the reason at all. Obama's had almost 6 years to make good on his promise that he would close Guantanamo in a year. Today, Guantanamo remains 142 people. Over half, 73, have been cleared for release, have been there 12, 13 years. And we're going on, coming up on January 11, 2015, the 13th anniversary of Guantanamo, and yet it remains open. So what's the problem? The problem is, yes, there are some restrictions that Congress has put on. It requires certification by the president of various things with regard to people he transfers, but unfortunately, he hasn't been willing to do it. Yes, he's transferred seven people recently, and there'll be a handful of more being transferred out, but the 50-some people who are from Yemen, he refuses to transfer to Yemen. He could do it. What this headline did is it somehow gives Obama an excuse, says this is why he's not closing Guantanamo. But in fact, of course, it's Obama who has been unwilling to pay the political cost to the extent there's any in the United States of closing Guantanamo. Of course, there's a greater political cost across the world of keeping a unlawful, illegal detention center open, one in which people aren't charged with any crime. And in fact, the UN committee, which just went over what the U.S. obligations were under the Convention Against Torture, again said Guantanamo must be closed. Keeping people in that kind of detention without charges is a form of cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment. So it's not about the headlines. It's not about Congress. It's about Obama. And as I sit here in London, I think on a Londoner who is still in Guantanamo, there's been major campaigns to bring Shocker out of Guantanamo. He was cleared for release. Listen to this. First in 2007, then in 2009. Yet he remains in Guantanamo. So the failure here is our president's. And on January 11, 2015, I urge all of us to get out, demonstrate, and tell Obama it's time to shut it down.
Michael, before you got to London, you were in Sweden last week for the presentations of the Right Livelihood Awards. Tell us what happened there.
I just came back from Stockholm, Sweden, where the Right Livelihood Awards, also known as the alternate Nobel Prize, are given out annually. Listeners certainly know of some of the people who received the awards. Amy Goodman has received such an award. And this time there were five awardees, one of whom was Edward Snowden. And that was one of the reasons I was there, because a number of us who were involved in defending, protecting whistleblowers were in Stockholm for that award. The awards are not given by the Swedish government. People should understand the Swedish government is not a progressive government. It's not a progressive country. It's tied with Israel as the third biggest arms dealer in the world, arms salesman. It's conformist. And the alternate Nobel Prize, while it's given in one of the houses of parliament, it's not official. The opening was given by a man named Jacob von Uexküll, founder of the alternate Nobel Prize, and he gave a really strong speech. One of the former winners of the alternate Nobel Prize is someone I know well and who we work with, Raji Sarani. Raji Sarani lives in Gaza and with the founder and runs the Palestine Committee of Human Rights. Unfortunately, just as he couldn't be in Berlin when I was there a few weeks ago for a meeting, he couldn't attend the alternate Nobel Prize celebration because he's been locked into Gaza. As listeners may be aware, he can't go through Israel, and Egypt closed almost 99% of the time, closed the Rafah exit out of Gaza in through Egypt. So he's locked in Gaza, was there during the war. What was wonderful about what went on at the alternate Nobel Prize was the one thing Sweden did do was recognize that Palestine should be a state, which was very positive. And in Jacob's speech, he gave three or four paragraphs to talking about Gaza and Raji. I'll just read you a couple of the telling sentences. He began with saying, in Gaza, our 2013 laureate, Raji Sarani, and his colleagues at the Palestine Center for Human Rights have lived through months of terror. He goes on to say, the impunity for Israel's actions in Gaza devalues international law and spreads cynicism and terrorism. If one country can claim the right to invade, occupy, destroy, and kill, others will claim the same right. If you lock up an entire people, as in Gaza, this next phrase is important. If you lock up an entire people, as in Gaza, they will try and break their prison walls with whatever means they have. And then he ends the part on Gaza by saying, and on Raji, in short, nothing can be done without ending the occupation and the closure of Gaza. So there you have the opening to the alternate Nobel Prize. Then they had Edward Snowden, appear on a Skype screen from Moscow. Again, they wanted him to get to Sweden, but it was unsafe for him to travel to Sweden. And, of course, many of the supporters of Snowden, of Julian Assange and WikiLeaks, were in the audience, and it was a very, very special moment to have Ed Snowden come in on a Skype. Another winner was a man named Basil Fernando. Basil Fernando runs the Asian Human Rights Commission. And what's interesting about that is he takes on the Western view of human rights, the idea that someone's tortured. Yes, someone's tortured. In the United States, even though it's not very effective, you know, we can go to court, we can make a stink about it, we can publicize it. There's a Western narrative about human rights that we're at least comfortable with. That's not true of the Asian countries that Basil Fernando works in. He says the whole Western narrative on human rights makes no sense to them. It's not helpful to them because torture is an everyday occurrence. Torture is how their criminal cases go to trial. There's no infrastructure. There's no institutions for stopping it. And therefore, Westerners, NGOs and others, have to rethink how they relate to the global South in particular on these human rights issues. So Basil Fernando was quite interesting. He was a second laureate. A third was someone I'm sure we've all heard of on this show, Bill McKibben, who was the founder of 350.org. He made quite a dramatic, strong speech. One very strong point. He said to Sweden, you have coal and you sell coal and you use coal. why don't you think about coal like people are forcing people in South America, Ecuador, Brazil, et cetera, to think about rainforests? You're saying Brazil has to preserve its rainforests so that we get less climate change. Well, why don't you look at it the same way and don't dig your coal out? Look at coal as a rainforest underground. Don't dig it out. Essentially, don't put all of this on places like Brazil. Put this on yourself. Again, a very, very strong speech. Another participant who was there made me very proud was, of course, Daniel Ellsberg, still out there, still talking about protection of whistleblowers, talking about Edward Snowden, Julian Assange, and others. So Sweden was remarkable in terms of the Right Lively Award, the alternate Nobel Prize. But people also know that I and the Center for Constitutional Rights represent WikiLeaks and Julian Assange. And there's a European arrest warrant, a Swedish arrest warrant, for Julian Assange's arrest as a result of sexual misconduct allegations. That, as listeners know, is why he remained in the embassy, not because he's afraid to go to Sweden, but because he knows if he goes to Sweden, it's a one-way ticket to the United States. And he's been given asylum by the Ecuadorians because of that. Recently, there was some litigation in Sweden around the situation for Julian. It's been 4 years since that warrant was issued. 2 years he's been in the embassy. And the Swedish court, the middle court, said it's enough already. They told the prosecutor, you can't just sit on your hands while there's allegations and someone's in custody. 2 years he's been saying you can question Julian at the embassy and you haven't moved yet. This is beyond and in violation of your duties as a prosecutor. So the question now for Julian Assange, and really for the Swedish prosecutor, is what will she do now? There's allegations, yes. There's been no follow-up on the investigation at all. None. No follow-up. And what we had asked the court to do was dismiss the allegations because the Swedish prosecutor has failed to follow up. Unfortunately, the court didn't do that, but they did admonish the prosecutor. And so we're going to have to see how the next stage unfolds, but I'm hopeful. I'm very hopeful that we can get the Swedish situation resolved and then deal with the big bear in the room, that's the United States, and see this as the political persecution of Julian Assange that it is. So this trip has been interesting, both Sweden and, of course, London, where I am now.
That was our own Michael Ratner speaking to us from London.
Michael Smith, I understand that last week representatives from countries that are signatories to the Convention Against Torture met in Geneva. What happened?
They very strongly condemned the United States because the United States is a signatory to that convention, which makes it part of American law. And the Convention Against Torture covers what happened in Guantanamo and Afghanistan and so on. Although the United States denies that any laws were broken, Obama said, we broke no laws. And then he said famously, we have to look forward, not backward. But the people meeting in Geneva last week resolved that the United States should prosecute the torturers. Part of the convention says that torture should be investigated and reported. There has been an investigation, but it's been held up by the administration. The Senate investigated the torture. The investigation has been going on for several years, but they haven't yet released it. So the people in Geneva asked that that report be released in its entirety.
Michael, did the topic of police brutality in the United States come up during these meetings?
Yes, indeed. In fact, Michael Brown Sr., the teenager who was killed's stepfather, was there.
In Geneva?
In Geneva, yeah. And so the whole situation of police abuse in the United States and the murder of black people was discussed. And moreover, the excessive use of solitary confinement was also condemned. So it was quite a meeting. And it gives you an idea of how the United States is looked at when you get outside of the United States and what other people think about what goes on in this country.
It's so true. When you leave this country and you watch the news, for example, or read the local newspapers, you see a critique of this government that is missing in the mainstream corporate media that we read and watch every day.
You said it. 2 weeks after the non-indictment of former police officer Darren Wilson over the killing of Michael Brown, protests continued nationwide in some 170 cities, from classrooms to places of work to the streets to even football stadiums. Will a genuine movement gain traction in the wake of outrage and defiance after the grand jury decision? A movement coalescing against police violence will need to confront the police and resist the legitimacy of the state, writes Glenn Ford, founder of Black Agenda Report. He says the people of Ferguson's mass violations of the curfews and countless decrees of the militarized city, county, and state police were by definition illegal acts, which is what made the small town a model of resistance. Glenn Ford joins us to talk about the growing movement and the message being sent about routine police violence against people of color. Glenn Ford, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Glenn, we've seen in the last several weeks an explosion that we really haven't seen since Martin Luther King was assassinated. This has involved more people in more cities, about 170 latest count across the country. And how do you account for this? Explain your view of how this has all unfolded.
Well, clearly, and not to belittle all the work that people have put into this, there's been a pent-up energy that has been building, and I mean for literally decades. We have to compare this explosion, as you call it, of activism to the period of quietude that has lasted for decades, even as the contradictions that led to Michael Brown's murder and a multitude of murders kept on becoming more and more acute. So we have to understand that there were forces that were keeping the lid on the explosion. And finally, those forces could no longer do so, and we see the explosion and 170 or more cities exhibiting certainly a desire to launch a movement.
The reaction of what you've characterized in your reports in the Black Agenda Report by what you call the Black Misleadership class has really been quite something, and I think worth talking about. Last week, President Obama called a number of people, including people, young people from Ferguson, to the White House, and they met for a whole day. President Obama had this to say. He said, "Ferguson laid bare a problem that is not unique to St. Louis." And then he described, quote, "a simmering distrust that exists between too many police departments and too many communities of color." Glenn Ford, would you call the problem one of distrust, or is it something else?
No, black folks have never trusted the police and have never had any reason to trust the police. So if that's simmering, it's been simmering ever since there's been a black America. And the problem is not about trust. It's about power, the power of a community to protect its youth, its sons and daughters from being gunned down on the streets by these police or sucked up into the vast mass black incarceration machinery that has been a foundational principle of the organization of U.S. society for the last 45 years. And black folks have seen themselves helpless to stop the depredations of that system. And the helplessness has not been something inherent to black folks. It's because we've had a kind of fifth column in our midst that we at Black Agenda Report call the Black Misleadership class, which has engaged in a very enthusiastic collaboration with the same people who created this black mass incarceration state. In fact, enthusiastically funded it, supported it, passed its legislation. You know, back in June, there was a vote in the U.S. House and the Senate on a bill that would have prevented the Pentagon from transferring its weaponry and all of its militarized gear to local and state police departments. Four out of five congressional black caucus members either voted against that bill or abstained, 32 out of the 40 voting members. So 80% of the Congressional Black Caucus, and I guess it's fitting that they stand in for this entire Black misleadership class, some of them elected and some of them not, 80% of that class voted to militarize the Ferguson police and the New York police and the Chicago police. They were financing the murder of people like Michael Brown. So this is our problem, that these are the people who keep the lid on what should be an ongoing, not simmering, distrust, but an ongoing explosion of resistance to this apparatus that warps all of the social relationships, and I mean intra-black social relationships, and has resulted in one out of every eight prison inmates on the planet being an African-American. Those are the ones who survive to get to prison.
Glenn, before we ask you to characterize what a good, positive leadership would look like, I just wanted to ask you a bit about the increased militarization of police. What factors do you think have contributed to the government, for example, giving war machinery from the battlefields of Iraq to local police departments and the Department of Homeland Security giving grants? Why do we see a ramping up of militarized local police?
Well, all of this started in terms of legislative form with the Law Enforcement Assistance Administration. That was part of an omnibus crime bill passed in 1968, signed by Lyndon Johnson, which began transferring massive federal resources to local police departments. Back in those days, you had lots of counties in which there was only a sheriff and maybe two paid deputies. I'm talking about in rural counties. After the LEAA came into existence, typically those counties would have 20 deputies. And in the urban arena, that's when we started seeing the militarization. And the first SWAT team in 1969 in L.A., quickly they proliferated. So this is not something new. I think ramping up has not been a big peak in the graph. It's been gradual, steady, and relentless, and now institutionalized. And when Obama invited those so-called civil rights leaders to the White House, and militarization was supposed to be somewhere near the top of the list, his administration has not backed off one iota from militarization. And you can see that in the interviews that were done with administration officials post that meeting. The Congressional Black Caucus, 80% of which voted in favor of continuing to finance the militarization, they all acted surprised after Ferguson as if they had nothing to do with it. But you can't believe in their sincerity. They were burned, and their actions that they took, thinking that they were voting in the dark, came to light. But they're the same people, and they remain the obstacle to creating a movement. And this is a movement that does not yet have a name, and it doesn't have a name because it's not yet clear about its objectives. There is a huge difference between this movement in the making and the civil rights movement. The civil rights movement was designed to afford blacks the same bourgeois liberties and protections under the U.S. Constitution, or that were implied under the U.S. Constitution, as whites. It was succeeded very briefly by a black power movement. And the reaction to this civil rights and black power movement was the mass black incarceration state. The prison numbers go up dramatically and keep going up starting about 1970. And so by early in the 21st century, the prison population has increased sevenfold. And in terms of the proportion of blacks and browns who are in prison, a total reversal of the ratio compared to whites. So we have a whole makeover in response to the civil rights and black power movements.
Glenn, what sort of demands do you think this movement just birthing. What sort of demands do you think should be made? One of the criticisms of the Occupy movement was there was no leadership intentionally, and there were no demands intentionally. And I think that that's changed now. And we have the Black Misleadership class talking about faith and hope, and you got to support the system, you got to support law enforcement, and so on. But what sort of demands do you think the real good leadership would be making now to pull together a movement?
Community control of the police, and it's a very, very difficult subject. It was the subject that the Black Panther Party was born attempting to tackle. And when we say community control of police, there has not been a conversation, a real conversation about what that means for decades. That's why when you say community control of police, I think the average person would confuse that with the term that people like President Obama like to use, which is community policing, which is really the opposite of any progressive notion of community control. That is, the people should be empowered to fire the police, just like folks are calling for communities to be empowered through their mayors to fire teachers. Isn't this amazing? Here we have a political situation in which public school educators, people are calling for their heads, demanding that teachers not have any contractual recourse to being fired en masse, and yet these public servants with guns who kill our kids on the streets have all the protections in the world, and you can't fire them, you can't even indict them, you can't convict them, they are untouchables, and yet they are the scourge of the community. So obviously we don't have anything like democracy in Black America, even in those cities that have Black mayors and Black city councils, the police are still a law unto themselves. And this is what makes this movement different, because the people who are in motion and who you want to set in motion do not believe that the police are legitimate. And this movement cannot treat the police as legitimate. That is, the coercive mechanisms of the state, their police and their security apparatus, their intelligence apparatus, has to be seen and opposed as illegitimate. So how do you create and manage a movement that states baldly that these folks, these cops, are illegitimate presences in the community, and then expect that people are supposed to treat them with respect when they are the problem? It is inevitable that there is going to be violence associated with this movement. You have to face that fact and resist those forces who would try to delegitimize the movement itself by associating it with the inevitable violence that will take place.
Yeah, exactly. Sharpton was at that meeting with President Obama.
He has many meetings with President Obama.
I know.
He's always in a huddle with Obama, and that's why I call him King Rat. I'm not really concerned, except in terms of what it reflects on his character, that he fesses up to supposedly ratting out on the mafia. I don't even know if it's true or not. But the real ratting that he does is he goes across the country and he makes an assessment of who is in opposition to the administration's policies or to the mass incarceration order, and then goes right back to the commander-in-chief of the regime and tells him who might be creating trouble and how that those troublemakers can be neutralized. That's the real rat.
I read an article 2 weeks ago about his birthday party at the Four Seasons, the ultra-expensive restaurant here in New York. The birthday party mm-hmm. was funded by a number of major corporations. Evidently, Sharpton is in debt to the tune of some million dollars. He hasn't paid his creditors, and he was holding a fundraiser with these corporations to get him off the hook. But He said, and this is an example, I think, of what you've been talking about, Glenn. Sharpton told reporters that he believed the president had committed to the use, quote, his full weight and put it behind changes in the system. And then Sharpton said, we live in a country that we must support law enforcement, but law enforcement must support justice. So really astounding. He would go there and use his prestige and his connections to get people back in the right track for him, which is supporting law enforcement. The other thing I wanted to point out, after they met in Washington with Obama, they agreed to continue funding Homeland Security to give military gear to all these police departments. And then they appointed a commission to look into things. And the head of the commission is the former chief of police of Washington, D.C., a man named Charles Ramsey.
Now working for that Quisling in Philadelphia, Mayor Nutter, yes.
Exactly, yes. Exactly. And so the woman, a comrade of ours in the National Lawyers Guild, a woman attorney named Mara Verhaeghe Hilliard, had brought the litigation against Ramsey's cops in D.C. for all the mass arrests they did for the demonstrations years ago surrounding the International Monetary Fund. And so the Times interviewed Mara, and she said, you'd be hard-pressed to find a more inappropriate choice. But I was thinking about it, and I was thought, you know, in one sense, that's, of course, that's true. But in another sense, this is the most appropriate choice, because this guy knows how to do mass arrests. And that's who Obama appointed to try to solve these problems for his misleadership class in the future. How do you do these mass arrests?
Yes, mass arrests and the use of provocateurs and such. This is what Sharpton's really talking about when he talks about the full weight of the president's office. We're talking about the full weight of the national security state if he feels that this movement is getting out of hand.
Yeah, exactly. And we're kind of running out of time, but I wanted to ask you if you could flesh out, when you talk about black control of the black community and community control of these police, what are you talking about? Having the cops have to live in the community, having a civilian review board with teeth? I mean, what sort of notions would you put forward?
All those notions have been put forward, and they're all very difficult. As Larry Hamm, head of the People's Organization for Progress in Newark, New Jersey, which I think is one of the best grassroots organizations in the country, has pointed out, almost all of these proposals have to be okayed by state legislatures. That's something beyond the voting power of even majority black cities. And so you shoot for that. Certainly you don't discourage people from putting those things forward as legislative proposals. But what we really know is the environment on the street is going to dictate what happens. That if we can't get democracy through the usual means, then you have to change the equation. And you change that by changing the environment on the street. And you make the regime do that which it was previously unwilling to do. You make the place ungovernable if there's not going to be community control based upon legislation and legal apparatus. That's the only choice you have. That's why there's going to be violence, because all of the conventional avenues can and will be thwarted. And in terms of who the leadership is going to be, we'll find out in the process of struggle. We have the leftovers of leadership from a struggle of two generations ago. We'll find out who our leaders are in this new movement from the struggle that's being waged now.
Glenn, it's just wonderful to be able to have you on the show. Thank you very much for your thoughtful remarks, and we'll be checking back in with you. If people want to hear or read a Black Agenda report, how do they get a hold of you?
Oh, in this internet age, it's so easy. You just said the words. Put www. In front of Black Agenda Report and add a .com, and there you are. And there's a new issue each Wednesday, which we're finishing right now.
Glenn, thank you so
Wednesday.
Keep up the great work, Glenn.
Out.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. Lawmakers in Ohio are rushing through one of the most extreme secrecy bills yet attempted by a death penalty state. It's called HB 663, and it withholds information on every aspect of the execution process, from the public, the media, and even the courts. Ohio has experienced 4 botched executions in 8 years. The most recent was the 26-minute death of Dennis McGuire in January 2014. In that case, an experimental 2-drug combination was used, and it was reported that Dennis was gasping and fighting for breath. Another aspect of HB 663 seeks to undermine strict distribution controls placed on foreign companies that manufacture pentobarbital. We talk about HB 663 with attorney Mike Brickner, senior policy director of the ACLU of Ohio. He recently spoke against the bill before a committee at the Ohio State Legislature. Welcome to Law and Disorder, Mike.
Thank you so much for having me, Heidi.
Now, we're interested today in talking about the specifics of HB 663, a law that really would make secretive how the death penalty is implemented in the state of Ohio. Why do legislators want to push through this bill?
Well, I think there are a few reasons why they're looking at this type of legislation here in Ohio. Firstly, they are trying to really ram it through during this lame duck session at the end, the last few weeks of our legislative session. And I think that they want to resume executions here in the state of Ohio in 2015. We've had a moratorium on execution since the beginning of 2014 when we had a botched execution of Dennis McGuire. And the federal court has been trying to come up with new protocols, new drugs that won't lead to another botched execution. I think that the legislators want to move forward with the next scheduled execution in February, and so they're trying to push it through as quickly as possible. I also think they're interested in secrecy because of all of the controversy that has plagued Ohio executions over the last decade. We've had 4 botched executions in our state in the last 8 years, and each time that that's happened, it has really caused a lot of concern from members of the public. And I think this is a natural reaction from the government, is that when something is not going well, they want to hide it from the public. And unfortunately, that never really works out well for the government, because when you operate in secret, the only things that follow are corruption, abuse, negligence, and incompetence. And really what we need when something is not going well is more transparency and more accountability.
Now, I understand that the proposed legislation would shield manufacturers, I guess pharmaceutical companies, and medical professionals who actually assist in executions from being the subject of public records inquiries, and it also provides immunity from ethical and professional reprimands.
Yes, that's exactly right. And in fact, it's even broader than that. The legislation would actually shield really anyone who touches the lethal injection process from public records laws. So not just the pharmaceutical companies or the pharmacists, but even people who manufacture other medical supplies used in the lethal injections, people who transport those supplies to the Department of Corrections, anyone who really touches any part of that lethal injection process. And it would also make it harder, not just for the public and the press to get that information, but even for the courts to be able to get that information. So you're really eliminating all accountability. And then for those medical professionals who do advise or assist on those executions, it would prevent the state licensing board from holding them accountable for violating their oath.
Mike, I thought that the Hippocratic Oath, which says do no harm, prevented medical doctors from this sort of activity. Am I wrong?
No, it absolutely does. And if a doctor or another medical professional was assisting with an execution, it would usually then be the duty of the state licensing board to take action for violating those professional ethics. Unfortunately, the Ohio bill, if enacted, would prevent the state licensing board from being able to do that.
Oh, that's really something. We've been discussing on Law and Disorder the role of the American Psychological Association, who had members involved in torture. There's a big controversy in that organization about whether those members should have done that and should continue to do that. And they try to draw a distinction between psychologists and MDs. But this proposed bill in Ohio would then allow MDs to do it. That's really amazing. Is this legislation, do you think it's got legs? Is it going to spread to other states where the death penalty is still practiced?
Well, that's what we're very fearful of, is that unfortunately bad ideas often travel quickly. We have 5 states currently that have secrecy legislation of some sort in place. And we've had, I believe, 15 states that have tried to enact secrecy legislation. Ohio's being so extreme, we're concerned that some of those really bad pieces of the legislation will be enacted by other states. And it could have a really negative effect. One of the other, I think, extreme pieces of this legislation that we haven't seen in other states is that it is trying to void contracts of foreign drug manufacturers, mostly in Europe, who have said that they do not want their drugs to be sold to state departments of correction for use in lethal injections. And this is really because the European Union has laws saying that drugs cannot be used for those executions. The state of Ohio is saying that if a company in Germany contracts with a company in Cincinnati to sell them drugs, and as part of the contract it says, well, you can't turn around and sell it to the State Department of Corrections for a lethal injection, that the state of Ohio will void that contract, which I think is very legally questionable. But if it's allowed to stand, I think there's a very valid concern that some of these European drug manufacturers may not want to sell their drugs anywhere in Ohio because they might be put into a position where they're going to be violating European Union laws. And ideas like that could very quickly take hold in other legislatures and have really terrible consequences.
That's actually fascinating. It leads me to a related question about compounding pharmacies, and I wonder if you could explain a little bit why the issue of anonymity for drug manufacturers is problematic for compounding pharmacies, and what do they do specifically?
Sure. So compounding pharmacies are kind of smaller companies. Oftentimes they can be even just one or two pharmacists, and they make small batches of drugs made to order. They are not regulated in really any meaningful way by the Food and Drug Administration. So when they create these drugs in these small batches, one batch could be more effective or less effective than another batch. And when you're talking about a lethal injection where we need to ensure that they are conducted in a humane and constitutional way, if you have a drug that's being used in the lethal injection process that is not effective, you have a very high chance of that person going through an execution that will violate our Constitution. Similarly, because they're not checked for, the compounding pharmacies aren't checked for efficacy or safety, they also have a really long and sordid history of safety issues. There was a compounding pharmacy in Massachusetts, I believe, that had contaminated steroids that they sold all over that led to dozens of deaths and dozens of people being very ill from using those steroids. And so, again, the compounding pharmacies are have a very spotty track record, are very much unregulated anyway. And then if you add this extra layer of secrecy over it, where the press and the public and the courts may not be able to properly monitor them, it's just going to be a recipe for more problems. And I think it'll be a question of when, not if, there will be another botched execution here in Ohio.
Mike, how many states in the United States of America still use the death penalty?
I believe we are now technically at half of states and territories have either formally or in a de facto way abolished the death penalty. So they've either formally totally gotten rid of the death penalty, or they have not executed anyone for a long number of years, or they have no one sitting on their death row currently. And then on the half that are still executing, you know, there are states that only really execute people very infrequently, and then there are the high-use states. And those
like
are
Texas.
States, like Texas, exactly. And frankly, Ohio would be one of those high-use states, except that we execute people so poorly here in the state. We've had so many problems with executions that the federal court or the governor has had to step in on multiple occasions and put in these moratoriums. If we were up and running with how our schedule is typically done, we would be executing usually about one person a month. But we haven't done that for a number of years because of all of these botched executions.
And on a world scale, I know the European countries have outlawed the death penalty, and I know that Iran has the death penalty, China has the death penalty, North Korea. But on a world scale, I think there are 194 countries in the world. How many countries in the world scale still have the death penalty? Do you know?
You know, I don't know the exact number, but we are, as you point out, not in very good company. That really the countries that still use the death penalty are not those that we typically look towards as human rights leaders. And I do know that, you know, over the last year, especially with all of the problems with American executions, with the botched execution that we had here in Ohio, with the one in Arizona and Oklahoma, the UN Commission on Human Rights has been really concerned about these issues and has issued a few very, I think, strongly worded news releases and reports on these issues and has conducted some testimony on it. I think that people are growing more and more concerned that with the way that the United States is conducting its lethal injections, that we are really doing basically human experimentation, that we're using drugs and methods that we don't really know if they're going to work, and we'll only really know the answer after we execute the person, whether or not they go through a cruel and unusual execution. And the international community has, I think, become more and more concerned about those things.
Mike, we just have a few minutes remaining. I wanted to ask you about your recent testifying before the Ohio State Legislature. What kind of response did you get?
Sure. So I testified about 2 weeks ago in front of the Ohio House, and I think that there is growing concern about this legislation. Again, you know, it's being very much fast-tracked through through the Ohio State House right now. But I think that there are more legislators that are concerned about these secrecy provisions and also the fact that we are pushing this through in such a fast manner when they are, you know, really important and complex issues that we're discussing. I think what's also helped is that more organizations who may not typically be seen as anti-death penalty are coming out on this legislation. So we've had the Ohio State Medical Association who weighed in and was not happy with the provisions preventing them from holding their colleagues accountable for violating their oath. We've had the Ohio Newspaper Association and the Society for Professional Journalists also come out in opposition. We've had the Ohio Catholic Conference of Churches come out on this legislation as well. And so I think that more legislators are seeing the problems with this. We do have testimony in the Senate scheduled for tomorrow at 9 a.m., and I'll be presenting again as well. It's not scheduled yet for a vote tomorrow. So if it were to be voted out, it'll likely be next week. But I think that we're seeing more people concerned about this. So our hope is that the legislature will apply the brakes to this bill and not pass it during the lame duck session.
And Mike, I know that the American Legislative Exchange, ALEC, the
right.
group that came up with Stand Your Ground and the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act, among other legislation, are pharmaceutical companies and ALEC at all behind this?
You know, I have not heard of whether or not ALEC has been behind any of the current legislation. I have heard in other states some concerns that pharmaceutical companies may be involved in some of this. I believe that there were some news reports from both Texas and Louisiana who have had proposed legislation that was not successful, although it looks like Texas may pass it in January, that there were some state officials, people who sponsored the legislation in those states, who had been given campaign contributions by pharmaceutical companies. And so there's a concern that there may be ties with those companies to that legislation. I haven't seen any direct evidence of that here in Ohio yet, specifically.
We are speaking with Attorney Mike Brickner, who's the Senior Policy Director of the American Civil Liberties Union in Ohio. Mike, this is really a fundamental philosophical question, I think, the death penalty as a whole. What do you say to people who say, it doesn't matter to me whether you perfect the procedure or not, whether you can kill a person painlessly in a matter of seconds or, you know, if you get to that point, that's not an improvement because on the whole, the death penalty has proven to be counterproductive. It doesn't stop crime. It's mostly used against non-white people. The fact is that no millionaire in the history of America has ever been executed. It's a classist thing as well. Why don't we join the rest of the civilized world who says we shouldn't kill fellow human beings? So what do you say to criticism that you might get from people who say, well, I'm for abolition, period. I don't care whether we tinker with the process. We should just abolish it. What do you respond to that kind of criticism?
Well, one, you know, I would say that I wholeheartedly agree that we need to abolish the death penalty system and that, you know, the ACLU has been committed to abolishing the death penalty since our founding and has been something that we've worked on for decades and will continue to push for here in Ohio and throughout the rest of the United States. But I think that taking aside whether or not we should have the death penalty, we have to accept that the death penalty does exist in states like Ohio, and that if we are to have the death penalty, then we need to make sure that it complies with our laws and that those who are subjected to the death penalty are not treated inhumanely and in a way that will violate our Constitution. I think that we can do that while still moving towards abolishing the death penalty. I do love that you brought up people who want to abolish the death penalty Oftentimes I get more questions from the other side of people who say, well, I don't care if the system is perfect because I think we should just have the death penalty and I'm not worried if people feel pain or not. And honestly, I would say something similar to them that, you know, questions of whether or not the system works well and if it's open to the public, that shouldn't depend on whether or not you are for or against the death penalty. That if the reality is that we have a death penalty system here in our state, then whether or not you oppose or support the death penalty, we have to make sure that it works as best as it possibly can and that it complies with all of our laws and all of our basic standards of, you know, human decency. If we introduce secrecy into that, it certainly never will fulfill that.
Mike, on that note, I'd also like to add that in sort of death penalty jurisprudence, it's pretty well known that when Americans get the real facts about not only the procedures, but the impact and the fact that the death penalty is not a deterrent, when they have the real facts, in general, there is a change in public opinion against capital punishment, which is why I think the work you're doing to combat this legislation is so critical, because if the bill passes, it will be yet another way to withhold that information from the American public.
Exactly. And, you know, it's so important that we have to know what is happening in our name. The death penalty is the most severe punishment that we as Americans can dole out, and we have a responsibility to know how it is being used. And I think that the information is so critical to continuing this discussion about why the death penalty is inherently broken and inherently flawed, that we desperately need access to that information. You know, we're continuing to have those discussions here in Ohio. You know, we've seen the results of these botched executions over the years, where our state Supreme Court actually commissioned a task force and has come up with dozens of recommendations to help to reform the death penalty in our state. Unfortunately, so far, the legislature has only been interested in these secrecy provisions that would, I think, further devolve our death penalty system. But I think that having this access to information will only increase these conversations and hopefully bring about more reforms and people changing their ideology on the death penalty.
Well said, Mike, and it's really been a pleasure to have you on. We are enormously grateful for the work that you're doing.
Thank you both so much, and it was great talking to
you. Every success, we'd like to find out the outcome of this thing. So please let us know so we can get a wrap-up once I hope we win. Thanks,
absolutely.
Mike.
Absolutely.
Thanks, Mike. Bye-bye.
Bye.
If you want to hear Law & Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law & Disorder Radio on Facebook.